Hello, 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 and welcome once again to the College of Creation. My name is Dan.
And my name is Michael.
And we are Dungeons & Dragons DMs who love to homebrew items, spells, creatures, and features for D&D. And this is a show where we make brand new homebrew every single episode, inspired by prompts that we get from our community. They tell us all kinds of things that they would like to see us make, and then we make them. And it's great.
And today's is wild. It's another one of those really specific but also very open cerebral prompts that is a mechanic that doesn't exist and doesn't really need to exist. I feel very similarly this week to how I did when we created the new damage types.
Yeah,
where like you really have to figure out why you're doing it. So our prompt going into this week was create a new D20 test. Mm-hmm. The three D20 tests, of course, are saving throws, attack rolls, and skill checks. And that pretty much covers the whole game.
Right. I mean,
you really have to figure out why you would need a fourth one.
Yeah.
And so that was an interesting thought process this week.
It's very tricky. It falls into that same category as, like you say, the new damage types, or when we made the constitution skills, right? There's there's so much in this game that is already covered. And in fact, if you look at like other systems, like this is, D&D has much more covered than a lot of other systems. A lot of other systems do not have the same like level of stuff that it addresses. You kind of have everything you need out of the box. So mine certainly are very much designed and presented to be like, these are optional for a situation, like really situation specific.
Yeah.
But I won't lie. I think it was a challenge for sure to like come up with something that was, you know, you're really looking for a very large gap in the game.
I think I found one.
Okay.
But I'm not sure. I could have just gone out onto the limb so far that it breaks and I fall to the ground. Yeah, I think mine also is very specific. But mine is more of a replacement for something that exists already.
Mm.
So it's taking something out, removing it, and plugging my thing in. So
okay.
I feel like our two approaches are the only two approaches that really makes sense, like something super super niche and optional, or just a replacement for something to make it different.
Yeah, I didn't so much find something that needs to be replaced or anything like that. I don't even really think that I found like a gap so much as I found something that, like, in my experience and in I think a lot of people's experience, like there is a piece of the game that people just generally don't, you know, they don't enjoy as much.
Yeah.
And it's because the mechanics are very different than the mechanics that we understand for ability checks and for attack roll, like all of those mechanical things we understand very clearly. But once we get into like, you know, the grittier parts of the game that come out of an older tradition, that come out of like war gaming and come out of like hex crawling type games, you know, the game has shifted so much that like these mechanics don't always feel like they align very well. And then my other piece was just kind of like, here's an optional thing that might be fun. I have no idea. I've never tested it. That's how it goes sometimes, you know? That's just how it goes sometimes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Shall we get into the presentations?
I feel like there's not much discourse
that needs to be said.
I mean,
without actually talking about
I'm mostly just excited to see what you came with because to peek behind the curtain a little bit, Michael was very excited about what he is coming with today. you messaged me about it at least a few times, talking about your process and how like you had gone down a full rabbit hole. So I'm very thrilled to see what you have.
Yes.
Let me present what I've got first because it's going to be much less long-winded. I am certain of it.
I'm gonna try and keep mine as short as possible, but yes. Please have the floor.
I'm excited. Well, I came up, like I said, with two things that One is kind of, I think, readdressing something that I think a lot of people do their own homebrew ruling or house ruling for, because it's a piece of the game that a lot of people don't necessarily jive with. And the other piece was just something that I was like, hey, how can I use maybe an existing mechanical framework for something that's maybe a little more interesting and maybe gives a different way for players to use it. So my new D20 tests are called resources, or a resource roll, and mastery rolls. So the resource roll I like more, but it also isn't pure D20 test in exactly the prompt as written. On a long march through uncharted territory or uninhabited jungle, being prepared is of the utmost importance. You can use a resources roll to streamline supply tracking and provide an opportunity for greater creativity during long periods of travel and exploration.
Yeah, this is good. Yeah.
So this would take the place of like heavily tracking your like rations and what did you buy in town that you have in your packs? Do you have bedrolls? Do you have torches? Do you have candles? Do you have a lantern? Do you have wood, etc.? At the beginning of each travel day, so this would be intended to be used over a campaign that is almost hex crawl-ish, right? Like you are going through an area that you will be traveling for significant periods of time. At the beginning of each travel day, one player rolls the resource die, which begins as a D20. On a result of 1, the die is reduced by 1 size. If a 1 is rolled on a D4 resource die, all supplies and rations have been expended, and the party may begin to starve, may begin to struggle to find adequate shelter, and might have to take precious time to scavenge and forage.
Interesting.
Players may also elect to roll the resource die at any point to determine whether or not they have a specific piece of adventuring gear, such as rope, a lantern, or climbing gear.
Love this.
On a result of 1, the die size is reduced as normal, and the player does not have the necessary piece of equipment. The final piece of the puzzle is that the players can increase the resource die by 1 size by spending a full day foraging and scavenging for material.
Okay.
So this will take up time on your journey, right? So you know, if you have a deadline, or if you're trying to get somewhere by a specified time, or if there are other things are going on in the world outside of this, like, you are having to perhaps weigh how much time you have against how many more resources you have. You're getting down to a D8. Is it worth it for you to stop and bump that up to a D10 to give yourselves that little bit of extra room to possibly, you know, keep yourselves with enough supplies? But yeah, I think the second piece there is the piece that really makes it, that provides the opportunity for you as a, as a table, not to have to do a shopping day thing for basic supplies. Like, if you want to do a shopping episode, I appreciate and love a shopping episode for fun stuff.
Yeah.
I do not like a shopping day for the banal regular adventuring gear. And I think a lot of people agree with me there. It's the kind of thing where it's like, if you're on the road, if you've got enough space in your backpack that, like, you could reasonably have something, it would be nice to not have to think of it like 3 sessions ago, but instead you get there and you're like, oh, do I have like fishing gear? Like there's a river here or something like that. Wouldn't it be cool if I have fishing gear? And I'll just roll and see if I have fishing gear for this specific thing that we would like to try and do.
Yeah, that's a great thing. I am curious with the actual like resource die rolled at the beginning of the day, I wonder how many days it would take on average to land on a 1 and get all the way down from 20, 12, 10, 8, 6 down to 4. And I'm wondering if just a natural 1 is not a high enough percentage for the 20.
That is possible, of course. And I think part of this and the way that it is built is sort of related to the prompt specifically. I wanted to start it on a D20 because that's what the prompt is. But I think if you wanted to run kind of like a resource light kind of campaign and you wanted to still use something like this, start them in a D12. Say that it caps out at a D12 instead. And that, you know, immediately does it. What I like about it reducing in size and staying on a 1 is that, like, at first, you don't have to ration much. You can search through that pack as much as you want. Like, mm-hmm. you probably will not roll a 1 very often, right? So you have, like, you just were in a town or whatever. The other thing I didn't put in here is that, like, if you go to a town and, like, everybody in the party explicitly says, like, we're going to go and do a shopping run, reset it back to its max. Spend however much money. It's like, you know, I could put a gold cost in here, but, like, you know, DMs are going to be better at, like, setting their own prices in the game for what makes sense.
And basic supplies, like, that's never going to be the majority of your
expenditure. You can reset it for, like, if you, you know, if they only have 50 gold to spend instead of, like, whatever you set it at, like, 100, reset it up to, like, a D10 instead of a D20, whatever it is. But I think it's fair to say that, like, if they spend the full gold amount, they reset it. But the idea is that, like, once you're, like, stocked up, you're kind of just going through things, you know? You use your supplies normally, and then you get lower and lower, and you have to think more about it because the chance is so much higher that you're going to run out of stuff as you get closer and closer down to the bottom, which I think mimics the actual experience of, like, a long travel where you supplied, like, many, many days ago. Were you really strictly rationing at the beginning? Probably not. Probably you were using stuff more quickly than you probably needed to because, you know, you felt like you had excess. And then you get down to the end and it's like, really would have been cool if I didn't have that extra ration on day one. And there's a good chance that, like, a party isn't going to let themselves get to the point of being out of stuff very often. But it just, like, is, you know, it's another one of these tools that just increases tension, you know, if you're into kind of a slightly more crunchy game but don't want to go through the full encumbrance and tracking everything rules, like, this kind of thing can mimic the experience of, like, playing something that is kind of survivalist but doesn't go too terrible hard and isn't more a burden than anything. The second piece of this is the mastery rolls. With enough training and practice, a true master can surpass anyone in their chosen task. This optional rule gives players a new way to use their heroic inspiration to truly excel in their most reliable abilities. When you succeed on an ability check, attack roll, or saving throw in which you are proficient, you can choose to spend a heroic inspiration to roll an additional d20 and add it to your original result. If this new total exceeds the original DC by more than 10, you gain additional effects listed below based on the type of roll. So if it's an ability check, you gain expertise in the skill used for the triggering ability check until the end of your next long rest. Mm. Mm-hmm. If you already have expertise in the chosen skill, you gain expertise in a different skill of your choice with which you have proficiency. If it's an attack roll, you can choose to either make one additional weapon attack as part of the same action or deal one additional damage die for this attack. And if you would take half damage from the triggering effect for a saving throw, you instead take no damage. And if you wouldn't take any damage because it's not a damaging effect, you gain temporary hit points equal to your proficiency bonus.
This is fantastic.
So just, like, if you want to not use the heroic inspiration for advantage or a reroll or whatever you do at your table, you could potentially put this in there as something that's like, if you're really good at something, be really, really good at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, put your money where your mouth is. This is really nice. I think that it is not unbalanced, paired up against advantage, which once I started reading it, I was worried that this would feel super powerful compared to advantage, like how you would otherwise use heroic inspiration, because there's just as much chance that you're going to burn this and it's going to be a one and it won't help you.
At first I had this as if your second roll also would beat the original DC. If you roll basically the same or higher as you rolled on the initial one, then this is when you get it. But that felt a little like it was punishing you for getting a higher roll the first time around. And I didn't want to do that. So I was just like, so in this case, if you roll really, really good on the first one, your chances are way better that the second roll will get you to that,
right,
to that threshold. But I think also the limiting factor here is also it needs to be something with which you are proficient. So attack roll is going to be the most like common one of these that gets used, but I think it's also the least powerful of the additional effects. It's just one additional weapon attack or one additional damage die, which isn't overpowered really at all. That's akin to a critical.
The saving throw
one is beefy, but everybody only has two unless you have the resilient feat, right? So you might have three saving throw proficiency, but you kind of, most characters are only going to have two. So you can only use this on your two best saving throws, which for some people is going to be like really great sometimes, and some people it's not. And then the ability check one is, you know, it also is dependent on how many skill proficiencies you have. This is great for rogues and bards and stuff like that, because they have far more than anybody else. But the bonus is just like, and you get better at the things that you were already good at still, you know. So yeah, I think it just is something that gives them an option to use it on a success instead of a failure, which I think is fun. It doesn't risk the success, which I think was important about it. I didn't want it to be something that was like, you're gambling with taking away your potential original success. You're just like potentially not getting a extra benefit on top of it. You already still succeeded though. Anyway, yes, not overly complicated today, but I do really like these. And I do have to give the flowers to Jack, Dungeon Club Dungeon Master, who really, like so many of his creations, have sliding dice scale things. And that was a real massive thing for me, is like reading through some of his stuff and like realizing how effective the sliding scale dice mechanic can be. It's really, really fun. I want to use it for more things, so I'm glad that I got to use it for this.
I think it can be applicable for so many things that it's not put in place for currently.
It's like, such a good mechanic. That and exploding dice. Exploding dice is a massive mechanic. I love that. I love it so much.
100%. 100%.
So, Michael, what did you bring today? I'm so excited to see what you have.
It has been well documented on this podcast. It's a hill that I will die on 100% of the time. Alignment is the most important part of character creation. And I say that actively disliking the current alignment system.
You have like turned me on the alignment thing. I don't know if I agree that's like the most important, but I do think your take on alignment is way better and fresher than anybody else's take on alignment. And
all right,
like, you have made me believe that alignment is important.
It is important.
At the very
it's
least,
incredibly
it is
important.
At least important. Maybe not the most important, but at least it is important.
So I scoured the game. Scoured the handbooks, trying to figure out any type of nook or cranny in Dungeons & Dragons that could benefit from a new D20 test. And the only thing that I could find that doesn't have any affecting mechanics is alignment. And I've talked about this before. I've made countless TikToks about it. I think of alignment like a digital camera. Where the body of the camera is your base character creation, your class, your subclass, all the feats you take, spells you choose, things like that. That's the body of the camera, where you can kind of tweak those settings. And your alignment is the lens that you put out on the front. That's how everything else projects out into the world, and that's how you view and capture what is coming into your body, right? That is how your senses perceive the world around you. And the way that alignment is set up currently, it is not functional for how an actual living, breathing creature would do that. So if you would open your document, Dan, today I present to you The replacement for alignment, I call it character morality.
Ooh. Oh.
It is a beefy amount of text. I'm not going to read everything word for word because it's a lot.
Yeah.
This is almost for no one, I think.
No, this is good. This has, just for the listener out there, this has a number of sections. It's got multiple images and like diagrams going on here.
I do have charts.
I would very much encourage anybody listening to head on over to our Patreon. That's patreon.com/collegeofcreationpod. And you can access this and see this document for free. Just come on in, go check it out. You can join as a free member and get access to this here chart situation. Please explain to me how this chart works.
Okay, so this is the new morality chart. So when you're creating your character, you decide your morality by completing the following chart. As a rough description, this chart has two columns. To the left, there is good and evil, with three kind of fillable bubbles behind. Think like Scantron tests. There's good, there's evil, and three bubbles behind each of those. And then on the right-hand side, there's a number of neutral traits. I selected six traits that I thought were not inherently good, not inherently evil. It's subjective how you would interpret these traits within a person.
Mm.
So they can skew good, they can skew evil. And these six traits are control, curiosity, tenacity, rectitude, dissent, and joy. And these are the six traits that I use to gauge where my character is from a moral standpoint.
Wow.
So let's get into it. On the left, you choose how strongly you align with a good or an evil root motivation. So that is a bolded word, root motivation. On the right, you choose how much stock you put into six personality traits that make up your peripheral morality. So the root cause is good or evil, and everything around it, the periphery, is these six other traits.
Okay.
So every creature, at its core, possesses a certain amount of goodness, whether they are wholly just and completely void of darkness, or they have been overcome by their most evil tendencies. Creatures are motivated by the position they hold along this scale. At the outset, your character either leans towards being and doing good or evil, or they can remain neutral. I'll explain that in a second. Whichever root motivation has more points assigned to it is your current primary motivator. So we'll explain points in a second as well.
Okay.
Put points in this chart.
You got like a skill tree, but it's like a morality tree situation happening.
It is essentially a morality tree. Again, I don't know who this is for. This adds a significant amount of crunch to your game. It also adds a significant amount of flexibility as far as alignment and like humanistic tendencies are concerned. And those two things tend to be enjoyed by players that are diametrically opposed. So I think half of this chart will work for half of the players. The other half of this document would work for the other half of the players. Nobody would want to use the entire thing, except for me. I think I'm the center of the Venn diagram, but we persist nonetheless. These are the options at level one. You can be good. You can find kindness and empathy in others, very easy to spot and connect with. You likely choose diplomacy over violence. You could be evil. You find that heroes, quote unquote, tend to be flavorless and trite. The magnetism of power and influence is typically more interesting to you than seeing society's success or development, or you can remain neutral. You find yourself stuck between those two powerful influences. You tend to have choice paralysis when it comes to making tough decisions, but also you can be remarkably good at mediating because of your lack of bias. So those are kind of the three options at the base level. You also have your peripheral moralities. You have your control. How easy can you exhibit restraint or command a tense situation? Curiosity. This is a measure of the importance one places on knowledge, discovery, and the gathering of diverse opinions. Tenacity. How fiercely will you accept challenges placed in front of you? This might discern how much consideration is implemented before rushing into an uncertain situation. How much risk are you willing to put yourself in? Rectitude, how closely do you hold to your ideals? This doesn't necessarily dictate how good a character is, but how acutely they believe their actions to be good. Dissent, how willing are you to stand up to those who oppose or oppress you? This could serve as a measure of a character's grit and willingness to go against those in power. And joy, how much do you prioritize emotional well-being and fun? Regardless of destination, you seek secondary objectives that fulfill your need for happiness. So this covers a wide spectrum of characters, right? And none of them are inherently good or evil.
Right.
So they can fall either way. The next section, how this is implemented into the game. I call it progressive morality. As is true with any other part of your character sheet, your morals, ideals, opinions, and personality should change and progress throughout an adventure. Now, this is the big problem I have with alignment.
Right.
You select it at the beginning, or you don't. Like, so many people just forget to do it, and then it never really comes up again unless you have an alignment-specific weapon when you're level 19 or whatever. I think it should all be progressive, right? As you gain character levels, your morality will change. You might become more fervent in your search for knowledge or lose your need for anarchy. Some of these changes will be left to you to decide, and others will be influenced by the world around you. Character creation. At level 1, you're allotted 10 points, which are available to be placed into your morality chart. Again, this kind of Scantron-esque morality tree. Two of your allotted points must be placed behind either good or evil, ensuring that you have the option to begin your journey with neutrality.
Okay.
So you can put 2 under good, 2 under evil, or 1 under both, okay. Right? The rest of the points can be placed in any configuration behind the 6 peripheral traits. Now, there are 5 bubbles behind each of these 6 peripheral traits on the side, on the right side. The more points a trait contains, the stronger your conviction will be within that trait. The following is an example of what your completed chart might look like. At level 1, I have an example of a completed chart with 1 point behind good and evil, and then a smattering of points. The 8 points kind of spread almost evenly across the other side there.
Yeah, I like how, like, I mean, you know, to kind of describe how this looks, I do think, like, visually and like, understanding what each of these 6 traits or values, I think maybe is a more precise, like, term.
I think so.
For what they,
yeah,
are, right? Like, they're not necessarily what your character has necessarily, because that those traits are kind of determined by the ability score.
Values is
but
good.
But this is sort of a different metric. This is sort of defining what they think is important, right? Which things they sort of move towards and are drawn by, what forces. And so I think what's very cool is that I can look at this and I can tell you what this person is like. This person is fairly, you know, they're neutral. They don't lean particularly, like, towards, you know, righteous goodness or, you know, completely selfish and malicious evil. You know, just kind of a normal person who probably doesn't think about the concept of morality very much. Lots of points in joy. So this person is very frequently probably looking for the things that kind of make life worth living. The light things, maybe into, you know, comedy or entertainment more than anything else.
Yeah.
They probably think it is somewhat valuable to stand up for yourself and to, you know, people that can command groups of people or are in leadership positions. You know, there's value to those things for sure, but it's not necessarily a driving force. This person isn't like a go-getter trying to get into the positions of management necessarily. But you also have no points in rectitude, which to me says that this person can be swayed incredibly easily.
Oh, for sure.
They're neutral.
Yeah.
And they have very little allegiance to their strongly held beliefs. They don't have strongly held beliefs. They are...
Right.
Pretty easily shaken, probably, by things that are somewhat entertaining and have a little bit of mystery to them. This gives me a perfect picture for who this character is and how this character, like, sees the world and how the various NPCs around them would perceive them and try to interact with them, whether manipulating them for ill or good, right? Like, I understand how this person can be manipulated very clearly based on this chart. So I think that's cool.
That makes me feel so good. That makes me feel so good. One of the things that I dislike so much about the 9-box chart for alignment is if you were to look at that 9-box chart the same way that you just looked at this, there are 1,000 different ways to be neutral good, right? Mm-hmm. You can, you're neutral, but good means something different to everybody. So you can be neutral good, like especially the extremities, right? Lawful evil, hugely wide berth for what lawful evil can mean.
Yeah.
Chaotic good can be so many different things. This has, I think, enough specificity. Like you said, you can get into the minutiae of what a character enjoys or what they're all about just by looking at their chart before you even go into anything else. Anyway, let's move on.
Yeah.
at higher levels, when you gain a player level, you can remove a point from one peripheral trait and add it to another. At each subsequent odd character level, so 1, 3, 5, etc., you gain one new point that can be placed behind a peripheral trait of your choice.
Okay.
So as you progress, you can add things, right? Your morality changes. It develops, it ebbs and flows, especially every level. You can be swapping points in and out. At each odd level, you could go from no points in something to 2 points, or 2 points in something to 4 points. Mm-hmm. It has the ability to sway heavily, or just kind of even itself out however you want it to kind of manipulate throughout your leveling journey. But good and evil, the most important ones. Unlike peripheral traits, your good and evil motivations can't be chosen manually after level 1. Instead, any changes to these point totals are decided by the other players seated at your table. If at any point in the game you take an action that results in an unequivocally good or evil outcome, another player at the table can motion to change your root motivation point standing in one of the following ways. They can add a point to either good or evil, they can remove a point from either good or evil, or they can remove 1 point from one root motivation and add it to the other.
Yeah.
If all other players agree, this change takes effect immediately. It is very important to have a table-wide... I have this written down. This is not off the cuff. It's very important to have a table-wide discussion during your session zero about what may be considered extreme enough behavior to warrant a shift to a player character's root motivations, especially in regard to the third option, if you are actively taking points away from one and giving it to the other. Because at least if you're adding or taking away, the other kind of stays the same. You're not messing with both sides of the coin. But if you're taking and giving to the other, that can be a pretty heavy shift, depending on what it is. So that's the big crux here.
Yeah.
Is that your core, you as a person, you can control a certain amount of your values, right? You can seek out things that entertain you. You can seek out groups or classes or things that can make you a better speaker or leader or entertainer or whatever. Good and evil is largely not up to you, right? It is the age-old question, nature or nurture. If you are going about your day making these decisions and if you make a bad decision without thinking about it and it results in something catastrophic, the other players in your party can say, I don't know, man. I think you have some work to do to get back to where you were. I think you skewed too far to the evil side. We're going to take one of your points if they all agree.
I have two thoughts about this. One is, does the person playing this character also factor into that everyone having to agree?
I don't think so. I have very purposely left the player and the DM out because I don't want to give the DM too much power here because they already control the rest of the game. So I think it should be just the other players at the table, not the one in question and not the DM.
Interesting. Because my other question was going to be, like, I think this presents an interesting potential in ways that I can see being good or bad, like, or very bad.
Yep.
But I think also, you know, for myself, you know, at tables that I've been at, like, I know, you know, some of the games that I've played at, this would be a really interesting way, and I think the players would be receptive to this being a really interesting way for me as the DM to create and lay out consequences that are very clear, like, before taking an action, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that are not the same consequences we always give, right? That are not the same, like, you know,
you're gonna have disadvantage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Disadvantage, or, like, you know, all of these other mechanical things. This provides something that's like, I as the DM can say, like, okay, cool. This action is possible in this case, but this is stepping outside of what you have established are your, like, character's values. And if it is important enough to them, to your character, and to you in this moment to go through with this action, this is the consequence for doing that. Like, and then the player goes in with full knowledge that, like, yes, I understand those are the stakes. I am willing to do this because it is worth, like, whatever result happens here.
Yeah.
And the other side of the coin as well, to say, like, hey, if you succeed at this, this is so selfless and so, like, in line with something that you maybe didn't even think your character was capable of at their current, like, neutral or even evil state, that, like, the reward, if you are able to pull this off, will be a sea change in your alignment or in your morality, right?
Yep. Like,
I think it could be, again, at the table, you have to be, like, very up above with all of those conversations. It could be a really interesting way to say, like, hey, here's a different reward and penalty system, or not even penalty, but just, like, reward and drawback situation that, like, is roleplay and narrative focused, and that we all agree upon. I think the agreement, regardless of how you implement this, is really important.
Yeah.
But I do think putting it in the players' hands is also really interesting for that factor of, like, you know, your morality is often defined by how others see you, not so much how you define yourself. So I think that works.
Yeah. I mean, without saying that this should not be implemented at any table if even two or three players have not played with each other before.
It goes without saying.
This is a group of friends that you have known for a long time, that you trust as players, that are going to handle their characters with care, and handle the game and the story of the game with care. And if you all go into this situation knowing that at any moment, a plot driver could be you making a snap decision and having this as the result, like a semi-permanent moral stain, if not temporary, for a majority of the game, potentially, until you do something to rectify your behavior or slip back down into evil, depending on which direction you're going.
Yeah.
Moving on. Still, because we have not gotten to my D20 test yet.
Finally.
I promise it's here. So this is the D20 test in question. This does not make sense without all of that buildup. I had to rebuild the morality system for this to make sense. So I call my new D20 test a morality plea. The shift from an alignment system to character morality comes with the addition of a new D20 test. Throughout your game, your GM may call for you to make a morality plea. A morality plea consists of a rolled D20, along with a modifier, which equals the number of points assigned to your primary motivator, which is either good or evil, whichever one has more points. So that number of points. Plus the number of points assigned to the peripheral trait you'd like to use to focus your plea. So you can make a plea of curiosity. You can make a plea of rectitude. However many points are in that row, that is added to your modifier. A morality plea differs from the other D20 tests in the aspect that it leans heavily into the narrative pieces of gameplay instead of the mechanical ones. More often than not, when you roll a morality plea, it will only affect the morality of another character or yourself, and even then, it's often temporary. Listed below are a few common ways a character could put a morality plea into effect, though you might make a plea with a different purpose with the approval of your game master. So the first option here I call appeal. This type of plea tugs at the heart and mind of another creature, possibly to steer them away from a questionable decision or attempt to convince them of your point of view. You could have an influence plea. While you can't change a creature's root motivations, you can certainly try to influence them in one direction or another. A plea meant to influence is typically rolled towards a creature of opposing morality, perhaps to resolve a conflict without violence. You might ask, why not just roll intimidation or persuasion? I don't know. I don't know why you wouldn't do that.
I mean, I think...
Leaning into morality instead of skills, I guess.
It also kind of like... it's often not clear what the actual opposing checks are for a persuasion check against like somebody else who has a character sheet, right? Like for NPCs, the GM is going to, you know, decide on a DC for whatever you need to do to persuade. But like, if you're doing this to other people who have character sheets or other people with any agency, or, you know, if the DM wants to just make this consistent across the board, it's a little cleaner, I think, than trying to figure out what makes sense. Does a wisdom check make sense? Does an insight make sense?
I also think this gives a little bit of an opportunity for a rotating face for the party.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a barbarian or a fighter that has 5 points in control, and they can step up and make these morality pleas like stone cold, right? They are unwavering at any moment.
You can play on different things than like a traditional, you know, charisma character would be able to, because, you know, not everybody is going to be convinced by, you know, the stirring words of a general type, right? Some people are going to be convinced by, like, you know, calls and pleas to their sense of logic and reason, which may be, you know, that could be dissent, that could be curiosity that you prey on there instead. And like, that might be in a quiet, hushed conversation and not in like a stand on a soapbox moment. Is that charisma? Right. Well, maybe it kind of feels like it has something to do with a different relationship than charisma necessarily captures all the time. So I think that's pretty cool.
I think also there's a genuine air to this. A lot of times people will make the distinction between deception and persuasion. Like persuasion, you're trying to be truthful. Deception, you're obviously lying. But even persuasion, there's an amount of, you know, falsehood that's in there. I feel like this is more of a genuine speak from the heart type of mechanic. Anyway, the third of three options that I have here is called reinforce. Most often rolled towards creatures who share your moral standing. Pleas of reinforcement are used to console, inspire, or care for others. It could be used to bolster the will of an ally who's lost confidence in themselves. And the last little part here, this is the last little thing, critical rolls. If you roll a natural 20 on a morality plea, the target of your roll, I want to make this optional for them if they want to or not. I meant to put that in there. The target of your roll adds 1 point to the peripheral trait you used to make the plea, if they want.
Okay.
That's cool. If you make a plea of rectitude to someone and it moves them so much, you roll a natural 20 and they're inspired to really steel themselves into their ideals. They feel the rectitude. They have the option to add 1 point to theirs. And I think I also want to make this temporary, like for 24 hours or something. So that really can capture like the commander, like the Braveheart moment, right?
You're
making this moral plea, riding your horse up and down your line of soldiers, and you're making a plea of tenacity, and you roll a nat 20, and all of those soldiers can add to their tenacity going into battle.
Mm-hmm.
Like the big sweeping emotional moments that I think are absent from the game as far as alignment goes, as it stands now, this could be a vehicle to heighten all of that, right?
Yeah.
I'm talking with my hands. Normally I don't do that.
All good.
Really
all good
stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is obviously very robust. It is complex, and it is, as you say,
yes,
a bit crunchy. So definitely not for everybody, but you know who it's for, Michael? It's for me. I like this a lot.
Hell yeah. All right.
It captures, you know, it captures like what the issue is, which is that, like, you know, alignment doesn't really speak to motivations. It doesn't speak to values, which I think is the more valuable thing for when you're inhabiting a character. You know, yeah, we build those things into the backstory, and we build them into the, like, optional questions when you're building your character in about their, like, you know, their personality, ideals, bonds, and flaws. But, like, people don't really use those very actively, and I think oftentimes they don't say very much, and they are static. I think what's really cool about this, and what's cool about your take on alignment generally, is how you think about it being fluid, right? And it is shifting, and like you say, when major things happen in the game that, like, shake the characters to their core of what they thought they believed or valued, maybe that person that we were talking about finds themselves in a situation where, like, terrible things are happening, and I'm finding myself, like, struggling to find hope and value in joy, because, you know, there's some oppressive force, and now I'm finding myself valuing these ideas of dissent more. I think it is good to stand up for myself. And as you get further and further along with that, you're like, oh, and now I have more rectitude as well. I am no longer so concerned with joy. And also, I've moved one of my traits from evil to good. And now I am a full paladin who has rectitude. I stand against forces of oppression because I have put all of my points into rectitude and dissent and good. Great. Like, I think it's a much more dynamic system. But do you also want to know what you've done here, Michael?
Yeah.
You have created a game unto itself.
Yeah.
I believe, and I am actually, I don't even believe, I know, I am absolutely certain that I could take this two-pager right now, and I could put it in front of some people, and we could play a full session of an adventure game with no other rules other than this.
100%. I just had that thought earlier today. I was reviewing this before we started recording, and I was like, I think this could be like a pamphlet game. I think this could
this
be
is a pamphlet
a very
game,
easy
Michael.
One-shot pamphlet game that would be fun. I think this could be a very good session zero one-shot to set up.
It's I mean, it's narrative driven. All of the, like, all of the bonuses and penalties are narrative in focus. Right, they are you know, it is all about, you know, like, your perception of other people and other people's perception of you and your actions. So, like, your actions that you take, you just take them and they affect your morality.
Yeah,
I think that's a fascinating game. That's a very cool game with a different resolution mechanic. You're not resolving the things that you do. You're resolving how they are perceived and how they affect your morality.
The thing that I like most about this, there are things now that we've talked about it that I dislike, that I would like to change.
Yeah.
Traits definitely should be values. I think that there are ways that I could pare some of these things down to make them more digestible. But one of the things that I really like, I think, like, more now that we've talked through all of it than I did even before, was that this can be a vehicle for both players and DMs to move story beats. It gives players a reason to engage in scenes that they are not a part of, which,
yeah,
a mechanic like this always leaves a door open for other characters who are not directly involved to become directly involved in a way that is specific and comfortable and table inclusive, because everybody has to be on the same page for the big beats. If there is a big shift, everybody has to be together. You all have to agree. If nothing else, I have made a togetherness mechanic.
Yeah.
I have made a way and a reason for a table to come together and make decisions all at the same time, which doesn't happen sometimes in whole campaigns. Sometimes it really is five individual characters doing individual things next to each other.
Well, that's great, Michael. I like it a lot. I appreciate that you brought it. And yeah, I think it's got a lot of potential, not just as something to add to D&D, but fully something that could stand on its own. But it does create what I think is a great framework. That's awesome.
I'm going to work on this. Catch my pamphlet morality game, Gen Con 2026.
Hey,
see you guys.
You could get it ready for PAX Unplugged if you really wanted to.
That's true. If I could work fast enough.
Well, Michael, shall we roll for what we're going to make next time around?
I think so.
I'm going to pull up the list of homebrew prompts that we have from our various listeners. They've sent us these homebrew prompts. We would love it if you out there listening would send us some homebrew prompts. You can email those to us at collegeofcreationpod@gmail.com if you would like. And you can also go on over to the aforementioned Patreon page. Once again, patreon.com/collegeofcreationpod. And you can send us a little message over there and we'd love to see you. And if you want to join just the $5 tier, you get access to some extra bonus content, some episodes of behind the scenes content cut for time, all this cool stuff that we're doing. We're doing little tiny creations. We're doing all kinds of good stuff over there. And we'd love to have you. Michael, would you please roll for what we're going to make next?
I would love to. Today, that's a 17, Dan.
17. It is going to be from Grace. New utility features for martial classes. Ah, yes.
Oh.
The oft underloved martial classes who often get very little to do besides hit things with a sword.
Yeah. Martial classes got a pretty significant boost in 2024.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of that had to do with power level and not necessarily expanding them as far as utility goes. Yeah, utility goes. So I don't know which direction I'm going to take doing this. It feels maybe not the right direction to edit the classes themselves, but maybe make feats for specific classes, or I don't know.
Feats or like items, classes perhaps.
That's a lot.
Possible.
That's a big undertaking. Yeah. Who doesn't like a good mechanic episode?
Yeah. These are always the best, the hyper mechanical episodes. But we'll be very excited to see what you come with next time around. And until then, thanks so much, Michael, for potting with me today. Thanks so much out there for listening. And we will talk to you next time with our utility feats for marshals. Until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.